Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Put Your Pants Back On edition. It's Wednesday, May 25th, 2022. On today's show, Men is the latest feature film from writer-director Alex Garland, he of Ex Machina and Annihilation. It stars Jessie Buckley as a widow retreating to a large, empty country estate in rural England. Folk horror ensues. This is a curious document I cannot wait to discuss. And then the Canadian comedy troupe Kids in the Hall returns with a new season of sketches. It's on Amazon Prime. We discuss that and a career that stretches back to the 1980s. And finally, Jody Rosen has produced his book on the history and mystery of the bicycle, Two Wheels Good. We'll discuss it with him. But joining me first today is Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hey, greetings.
All right. Digging in then. Harper is a young widow. She's leased an old country estate in rural England for, feels like the weekend, maybe the week, in no small part to continue processing the grisly suicide of her husband, who we meet in tormented flashbacks. He not only took his own life, he tried to take hers with him in a way by blaming her preemptively for what he was about to do. Harper only wants to be alone with her pain, but she discovers that the house, the grounds, and indeed the possibly the entire area are haunted by, well, that is the very dark twist at the heart of this movie. It involves her co-star, Rory Kinnear. Okay, in the clip you're about to hear, the main character Harper calls the English equivalent, the UK equivalent of 911, because a man is trying to break into the house where she's staying. We don't get a lot of dialogue here, but you'll hear at least, at the very least, the chilling sound design of the film. Let's listen.
Explain what's happening, please.
Oh, Dana. I mean, I watched this movie. I mean, there's so much to just unpack here. But one thing I'll say is just at the primal level, I'm a fraidy cat. I was alone in a movie theater in a multiplex in the middle of nowhere with my hands over my face for most of it. I mean, it is a dread-filled exercise. What did you make of it?
I mean, I think I have a tougher skin for horror movies than you or Julia do, which is not to say it's all that tough. Exactly. No, I get very easily creeped out by things. But this movie, for me, after the first hour or so was over, which I agree is sets a really dread-filled mood and had me excited for the rest of the movie, I think completely falls apart and becomes not only not scary, but not smart, not following through on its ideas. The last half hour, which I guess we won't talk about until our spoiler-filled bonus segment, was to me a complete disaster. And to me, it was a real disappointment, because I sort of find that this director, Alex Garland, who started off as a screenwriter and novelist and has now directed three movies, including this one, all of which I think we've talked about on the show. His movies have been Ex Machina, Annihilation, and now Men, have to me given diminishing returns each time. I mean, Ex Machina felt like, here's the debut of an exciting new director who's full of interesting ideas about technology and femininity and gender, and I'm not quite sure I totally get where he's going with this movie, but, you know, fascinating watch. Then Annihilation came along, and I felt like the stakes were upped, right, in terms of what you expect from the second time around from a director. He took on a more ambitious project, interestingly, with this, you know, idea of this team of women who go into this strange, shimmering, I don't know, futuristic space where different rules of organic reproduction apply. And that movie also, to me, fell apart at the end and never really carried through on all the great ideas that it floated. And that same dynamic where an interesting mood is established and a sort of beautiful world is created and then it all just kind of goes blomp at the end was just really, really notable in this movie. And the blomp was very loud and unappealing.
Okay, Julia, well, this is a mini spoiler, but I think anyone who's read any reviews, and it seems to be even in the trailer, would know this. So this movie is basically a two-hander that's also an ensemble piece with this twist. Rory Kinnear, the actor, plays the ensemble. He effectively is every male presence in and around this country house. He plays a cop. He plays a stalker. He plays a young, seemingly very messed up kid, violent, messed up kid. He plays a vicar. He is the men of the title of the movie in some sense. Was that like teasingly weird and vaguely nauseating or overly didactic and somewhat distracting?
I mean, I would just say that I stand with Dana's blomp at the end analysis of this film. And it's a disappointing blomp because the conceits here are very interesting. And I did, as the scaredest of the scaredy cats on this show, I really didn't like seeing this film. I was alone in the theater as well. And I like at one point kind of like stood up and stood in the back of the theater just to distance myself from the viewing experience because I did not want to get sucked into the world. So it was effective as a like mood setter at the beginning. My main feeling about this was actually like the Beatles documentary where you hear, you know, obviously you get to watch Paul McCartney invent Get Back, but you also hear them like noodle all these other things that like could have been hit songs, but aren't. And of course you don't have the earworm, but the notion of this director essentially arguing that the fact of being a woman in the world is to be the damsel in a horror movie because every man you encounter is actually like the same base instinct and obsessive desire and inability to see you as anything other than the mother and the fucky. That's like an interesting, provocative idea. I actually felt like maybe it was part of why I was finding the movie so unnerving. Is like, you know, the concept is just being a woman. That's the horror movie, right? And that's so interesting and really provocative and a provocative movie to make right now. And the performance and the sort of sameness and differentness of all of these characters that Rory Kinnear plays really marvelously, each of which is sort of an avatar of like a different kind of gross masculinity. But I think actually it's also where the movie starts to lose its edge and where the Jesse Buckley character Harper at the center of it. And again, she's like one of my favorite actresses working today. She does a good job with this performance, even though it's quite thinly written and often seems to consist largely of like a man saying something appalling to her and her going, "What?" Like she just says "what" all the time in the movie, but it like kind of works as character development. Yeah. But anyway, her like she doesn't seem to register that it's the same fucking guy, and so then you start to think she's like a little dim, or like she like he's obviously the same guy from the beginning, and so there's something about the way that she processes that turn that creates a little bit of unreality in her situation. I don't know. I Blomperino, like this could have been so good and it was not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sort of with you on that. Julia, you raised this interesting question is like, to what extent are we seeing a slightly forced, artsy, overly self-consciously cinematic touch by the director in making Kinnear all of the men? And to what extent are we inside her subjectivity? I mean, the action of the movie in some chronological sense begins with her husband, played by the actor Papa Asedu, is depicted as like just an incredibly emotionally needy weakling. I mean, he does among the weakest, most manipulative things a human being can do, which is threaten to kill himself because he's not getting what he needs from his wife, who now wants to leave him. And he, in the midst of that conflict, hits her. And so there's a primal act of domestic violence that initiates, in some sense, the entire action of the movie. I mean, it's the moment she definitively kicks him out. He very soon kills himself.
Well, and it's interesting, too. The movie kind of leaves it ambivalent. She's not sure whether he jumped or fell or what.
Whatever happened, it came from a deeply suicidal impulse, but it's left vague. And so are you sort of, I couldn't decide, am I seeing an allegory or a kind of strained metaphor on the part of the director? Am I seeing inside her consciousness, but it's being made concrete in a way that we're not supposed to take as her subjectivity exactly? It was like both overthought and underbaked at the same time, which is, I think, the trap his stuff gets into very often. And then I think there's another issue. I'd be very curious to hear the panel discuss it. Dana, you know, I kept thinking, oh, well, this is like Jordan Peele and Get Out, only using gender. Well, the obvious difference being Jordan Peele grew up as a black man in America. And so his parable about racism bites all the way down to the bone and beyond. This is a movie written and directed by a man. I'm not sure how I felt about that as a feminist gesture. It seemed like it was committing the very sin it was attempting to taxonomize.
I think this movie's actually about men. Like, it pretends to be about the experience of women who are subject to the whims and grossness of men. But it's actually about the, like, tragedy of being a man and being, like, trapped in all of these shitty forms that you can't get out of. And so it's fundamentally not that interested in her and her experience, I felt.
Brilliant.
And there's also, I think, in the way that the movie deploys sort of folklore and myth, the suggestion that, like, men are essentially fucked and it's ever been thus and there's no way around it. And I think there's something, I think the movie becomes much less scary in its final chunk, which we will discuss in the plus segment, in part because what it does in the final chunk is make men ridiculous in the face of women's power. And I actually think that's kind of sexist, like to both men and women. Like, I left with, like, a very bad taste in my mouth because, yeah, like I did find myself feeling as I watched this, like, I wish I had seen this movie made by a woman. The film had actually reminded me of, and this is maybe going to send up a flare in Dana's direction, is Promising Young Woman, which is another film that takes, like, the condition of womanhood as sort of the occasion for, like, a thriller or suspense or horror. And I know does that in ways that Dana really did not like or respect, but I'm curious to hear if this movie twanged any of the same chords for you, Dana.
I mean, in the sense that, you know, they both take on gender politics in such a clumsy way that, as you point out, they almost seem to be making the opposite point. They seem to be making points that are gender essentialist in ways that I don't think were intended by the filmmaker. I mean, the gender politics of Promising Young Woman are just, to me, just straight up deplorable. Like, if you really follow the logic of that movie to the end, what that movie bites off and doesn't chew well is even more extreme than in the case of this movie. But I completely think that this movie goes off the rails at the end and forgets what it's even about and becomes this sort of would-be gross-out fest that wants to leave you, I don't know, that just wants to shock the audience into having some sort of feelings about gender that the movie itself doesn't seem to have thought through. I even saw one critic in Vanity Fair, Richard Lawson, saying that he felt like almost unintentionally this movie played into the hands of and almost made the argument for sort of gender critical types, you know, the sort of transphobic discourse of the J.K. Rowling crowd. I wish we had Richard on the show to elaborate on exactly how he sees that happening at the end. I don't think that the movie thinks anything through clearly enough to be trying to do that or anything else. But Julia, I agree with you that what it's trying to say about men with a capital M, the title of the movie, and women with a capital W through these particular not very well drawn characters winds up seeming to inscribe gender stereotypes and gender violence more than it does trying to overturn them. And it makes no room for people who might occupy a different place on the gender spectrum than bad Rory Kinnear and endangered Jesse Buckley.
It just is so overbroad. Like, the problems with men and women are so much more subtle than the ones in this movie. And I get it's a horror movie and it's not supposed to be subtle, but it's such a potent topic and it's such a clumsy effort, and it just... It really feels like a drag.
Right, and it's a lot of filmmaking talent put to waste in a way, you know, because I do think that Alex Garland is a great visual stylist. And, you know, Steve was saying the sound design in the movie is really cool. It creates an incredible mood. And that first hour of that folk horror-esque, you know, period where she's retreating to this English mansion and creepy things are starting to happen is sort of like the beginning of a really good horror movie.
One thing I'll quickly say is that I just think, like, I totally agree with both of you. There's kind of a gender horseshoe politics here where left and right are coming together, right? The supposedly radical critique gets so radical, it becomes essentialist about gender identities in a way that reactionaries love to take advantage of. It's an idea that they love to deploy. And I think maybe that doesn't work. Okay, the movie is Men. As of now, it's only out in theaters. If you can believe, there's still acres of material here to explore and spoil. So that's going to go in the plus segment. So tune into that. All right, moving on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right. Well, before we go any further, this is where we insert a set of business alerts. This is our little bulletin board. Dana, you're made out of cork.
I'm full of push pins.
You're full of push pins. What's dangling from you today?
I appreciate your commitment to that metaphor, Steve. Our only item of business this week is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're going to have a spoilers-heavy Slate Plus segment because one of our conversations this week in the regular show is about the movie Men, the new Alex Garland horror movie thriller. And that movie is very, very twist-dependent. There's some things that you just can't really analyze without spoiling the crazy twist ending, which I'm not even certain that I totally understood. I really want to hash that out with Julia and Steve. So if you're a Slate Plus member, you will hear that at the end of our conversation. If you're not a Slate Plus member, you can always sign up at slate.com/culture plus. When you sign up, you get ad-free podcasts, you get bonus content like the segment I just described, and lots of other Slate podcasts have those too, and of course, you get unlimited access to all of the writing on slate.com. When you're a Slate Plus member, you will never hit a paywall, and you will also be supporting our work and the work of our many brilliant colleagues. These memberships matter a lot to us at Slate, so please, if you like listening to us, sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus to become a member.
Okay, well, the comedy troupe Kids in the Hall started out as a ragtag bunch of punk upstarts doing their outre stick out on Queen Street West in Toronto. This is back in the 80s. And in a way, even after stints on writing for SNL, appearing on HBO and now Amazon Prime, even with breakout members like Dave Foley finding degrees of big league stardom, that's exactly what they still are. Five irreverent Gen Xers whose mission was and is to, in the wake of Python and SNL and SCTV, take comedy in newer and even less expected directions. The new show is a nakedly, literally, and figuratively honest confession about what it's like to try to make comedy fresh as you approach the age of 60. Why don't we listen to a clip? Okay, in this sketch, there's been some kind of an apocalyptic event, and most of humanity has been wiped out. Nonetheless, a radio DJ played by Dave Foley continues to broadcast his show, even though he only owns one record to play. All right, let's listen to a clip.
Good morning, that was Melanie and Brand New Key, and this is your friendly neighborhood DJ, Mike Motormouth Mulcahy, on KROC, the Crocodile, rolling out the rock to whoever's left in whatever's left of the greater metropolitan area. The weather today is mostly lethal, so stay indoors. And by indoors, we mean underground in a secure bunker or an abandoned mine. Well, enough chitter-chatter, let's get at her. This is Motormouth in the Morning. Ready or not, here I rock.
Well, I got a brand new pair of old skates. You got a brand new key.
All right, Julia, let me start with you. I didn't have, a deep history with Kids in the Hall. I was fun making their better acquaintance for this segment. What was your history and what'd you make of the reboot?
I did encounter this as an anointed product as a teen and liked it, but wasn't a comedy nerd, didn't think of myself as particularly in love with any of this. And yet this is the first remake that I've had the full nostalgia. Like I was like, oh, this is what people must feel. Like the super 90s surf rock theme song comes on. Possibly the best thing about Kids in the Hall was the music, actually, yeah. All along, sacrilege possibly. But, and I had this feeling of they made this for me. This meant so much to me in my youth, and now they're back, and we're all aging, and death is near for everyone. And how does one reckon with one's evolution as a human on this planet if you're lucky enough to continue to rack up decades as they go? And I was like, I didn't even care about this show as a teenager. So I feel like I had a very personal reckoning with the power of nostalgia that possibly didn't have that much to do with the show itself. But part of what was appealing about the show, and part of what it leans into is its fundamental Canadianness, a fundamental like an alpha attitude towards its fundamental beta-dom, which is maybe what proud Canadianism is. The mail we can get about that, come at me. But it's interesting to talk about this in the same show as talking about Men, which leans very hard into scuzzy, outmoded, and not particularly nuanced versions of manhood. And part of what I think was radical and interesting and exciting about Kids in the Hall in the 90s was the modes of manhood that were on display, the ways in which it was teased and mocked, the playing with gay characters in ways that were perhaps not so common at the time. I think the show has a confidence in its own goofiness that is part of what it has always been about. And maybe that sounds like a baseline for any sketch comedy show, what sketch comedy show is not goofy and confident in its goofiness. But I don't know. Other shows are sharper, more pointed, or more satirical, or more nasty, or more canny, or more trying to be relevant in some way. And this show is just truly out to lunch in a manner that feels freeing and felt dated and fun.
Yeah, I agree. Dana, what do you think?
Yeah, I did not, unlike Julia, have a real relation to the show at the time. I was very aware that it was there and that it was an important influence on other comedians. I think I probably knew about it mainly as the previous thing Dave Foley had done before News Radio, which I did watch and did love.
Yes, love.
But I feel that same sort of generational nostalgia and affection for this kind of humor. And going back and watching some of the old segments from the original run of Kids in the Hall made me realize that it was more progressive. I don't mean necessarily politically progressive, but at times but cutting edge in comedy than it had seemed at the time. I think that probably it seemed at the time a nicer and less edgy show than some other comedians of the 90s, because it is a pretty apolitical format and is usually more about sort of pursuing group silliness and taking funny social situations as far as they can go. But for example, the character Buddy Cole, who's this recurring character on the old Kids in the Hall, and I believe makes some appearances on the new one as well. I haven't seen all the new episodes yet. He's played by Scott Thompson, who was an out gay comedian, not a very common thing to be in the late 80s. And And he's this really interesting character who runs a bar called Buddy's, is usually seen in the bar, has a very flamboyant, you know, sort of stereotypically gay style, not unlike Stefan, the Bill Hader character on Saturday Night Live. I mean, a very different type of stuff that he talks about, but similarly kind of employing these gay stereotypes in a way that is not hateful. But the fact that Thompson himself was an out gay man, you know, gives a different feel to that. Anyway, those Buddy Cole segments that at the time probably would have gone over my head, or maybe I would have thought, you know, this is stereotyping or something, now seem really radical in their willingness to just place that character front and center. And, you know, Buddy Cole has all kinds of offensive ideas that he sits and muses about straight to camera.
Now that I own a gay bar, I can't stay in the closet anymore. I'm as high profile as a city councilor.
So that was one thing that struck me. And I mean, in terms of everything old seeming new again, I mean, I would have to say that the present day comedy sketch show that this most reminds me of, though their sensibilities are somewhat different, is I Think You Should Leave, which we've talked about on the show before, which similarly is a group of people, mainly men, with similarly weird senses of humor, just setting up strange premises and then taking them as far as they could go. And I Think You Should Leave also operates with a kind of minimalism that Kids in the Hall shares. I mean, I'm thinking of the head crusher guy. Are you familiar with this character from the Kids in the Hall days, right? Who just sort of likes to stand around outside office parks and express his hatred for all humanity by pretending that he's crushing the head of everyone he sees between his pinched fingers. And it is such a childish joke. It's like something that a kid on the school bus would make in seventh grade, right? Just crushing everybody they see with their fingers.
Hey, Wall Street, don't panic. I mean, I'm only crushing your heads. Crush you.
But before there were memes or an internet to put memes on, the head crusher guy was, as I remember, sort of a meme in his day, just a silly little character, sketch character that you could kind of recreate in your own everyday life. So I don't know. I guess I vibe with the Kids in the Hall, despite, unlike Julia, not having a super strong sense of nostalgia for the original.
I watched the documentary that accompanies this about Kids in the Hall. I thought it was really fun and really enlightening. And Mike Myers is sort of the A-list, you know, SNL and feature film alumni they bring in, who's Canadian, to say, you know, like, these guys were geniuses. I saw them, you know, says Myers, back on Queen Street. The only thing in the world I wanted to be was a member of Kids in the Hall. He like would cameo with them, but they didn't let him in, whether he was too young or just didn't fit or whatever. And I'm like, Mike Myers made me laugh, right? Like, that was the generation of SNL that started to resurge and was finally reminiscent of what had made the original show great. And Myers was a genius, and he had that weird, like, what planet are some of these characters coming from? But Kids in the Hall never made me laugh, right? And even watching the doc, I was like, God, I'm not laughing at any of these supposedly classic skits. Like, I just, something about the energy. I mean, I admire everything about it, right? I admire that they poached, Lorne Michaels comes in, you know, the fucking devil himself from Faust, and poaches two of them. You know, their essence is as a fivedom. He poaches two to be writers on SNL in the mid-80s. SNL sucked in the mid-80s. It was a fucking viper pit to work at, from everything I've heard. Thankfully, they didn't fit in. They didn't get totally lost. They were like, this fucking sucks, and they made their way back up to Canada. They've had this, now, what is it, 35 year, whatever it is, relationship with Lorne Michaels, who is their Faustian handshake, you know, who really believed in them. He doesn't come off as a villain, but they have a wonderful, their beta-ness next to his alpha-ness is a very, very delicious part of the documentary. And he's spoofed in the new show. And here's another piece of whiplash. I loved the new one. The new one finally made me laugh hard. It's just, the proof is only in the pudding when it comes to comedy. The sketch where they're like Chippendale style dancers and these young attractive women, conventionally attractive women, are finding them sexy for being in their late, like, sad fucking sacks of human decrepitude in their late 50s. It's so funny. It's just fucking funny.
That's so interesting, Steve. I actually found this less funny. It did not make me laugh very often, but I enjoyed seeing these guys with the confidence of exactly what they have built in their career, and seemingly confidence in the things they have not built in their careers, which, you know, have fairly modest scope, just like embracing the idea of doing comedy together nearing age 60. Like one of the first sketches in the first episode involves two of the characters stripping down naked to evade some cops who are hunting them for a robbery and just like jumping around fully naked, full frontal, like, you know, just inviting us all to really study their physiques nearing 60. And, you know, that sort of speaks to the overall attitude is like, just take us as we are. And one aspect I did not like about the remake because of that is that it has these little interstitials of like the Kids in the Hall fans that are legendary comics who are more famous and celebrated, at least right now in the culture, than the Kids in the Hall guys are, pretending to be characters who love the Kids in the Hall. And I was like, it was protesting too much or something. It's like the whole point of these guys is they don't need you to know how much they're loved or how big they're impact is, they just are themselves, being themselves, enjoying themselves. And that felt discordant to me, those like, but Pete Davidson likes them too, don't worry, even if it seems a little lo-fi and a little Canadian, like someone you've heard of likes them. It had a different energy than the show itself.
Okay, well, I mean, worth checking out, certainly if you're a fan of the original, visit this one, but let us know if you're big Kids in the Hall fans, what you make of the reboot, but also where they fit in the kind of genealogy of comedy, somewhere between SCTV and what's come since. All right, moving on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Okay, well, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle is the new book by Jody Rosen, and it is as definitive, deep, dandy, and hard to categorize as the man himself. At once a thorough history, a memoir, a prose poem, and something of an expose. We'll talk about that definitely. The book shows us a machine and a man made of many parts. Jody Rosen, hi, buddy, and huge, I want to tell you, huge congrats. As Sisyphus with the rock only a third of the way up the hill, I am just really, really pleased that you brought this book, which I've been waiting to read forever, to completion. It is a wonderful, wonderful achievement. It is a genuinely great book. Congrats.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it. And I can't wait to read yours. No pressure, but...
all right. Well, moving on very quickly from that moment. The first thing that really amazed me about the book is that the bicycle seems so elemental, right? And yet it is so incredibly very new. It was invented relatively, like really, really recently. It turns out that inventing the bicycle is fundamentally different from inventing the wheel. Talk a little bit about that and also what brought you to the subject. You yourself are an avid biker. Let's get there too.
Okay, cool. Yeah, no, I mean, what you say about the bicycle's kind of belated invention is very true, and is also one of the kind of the great curiosities of the bicycle, because the technology that is necessary to build a bicycle has been available since the early Middle Ages, and yet it took centuries for somehow fate to get its act together and give us the bicycle. So when the first kind of proto bicycle arrives in 1817, which is not a bicycle with pedals, it's like a push bike. It's a bike that's propelled by essentially straddling the thing and running. That first bike, which was which arrived in the city of Mannheim in what was then the German Federation, the Duchy of Baden. It showed up at the same time, or actually 15 years after, like a decade and a half after the invention of the steam locomotive. By the time the bicycle was kind of perfected, there was a long history of a series of trials and errors and to produce the bike that we know today, which has two equal-sized wheels and, you know, a chain drive that pulls the rear wheel forward and, you know, the classic bicycle form, which was at that time in the late 19th century called the safety bike. The safety bike arrives in 1885, and that's the same year that Carl Benz produces his first Motorwagen. So, you know, we have a locomotive train is around before the bike, and by the time the bike gets perfected, the automotive age is upon us, is stirring. So it should have been around earlier. And for that reason, there's a lot of kind of bogus, apocryphal creation myths that have circulated around the bike for decades. People kind of projecting the bike back into history and saying, oh, there must have been an ancient bike that, you know, the Egyptians were tooling around on in the shadow of the pyramids.
Jody, to pivot from the history of the bicycle to the mystery of the bicycle, and this is the subtitle of your book, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle, which I love, I wanted you to talk about how you see this book as a nonfiction project, because it is an unusual kind of project and is certainly not an exhaustive history of that piece of technology that you just described the initial design of. I mean, you do definitely kick off with some history, but then what in the subtitle is called The Mystery of the Bicycle, sort of a more reflective, essayistic, and I don't know, I would say a personal history of the bicycle is also woven into that. And that also leads to some kind of formal innovations in the book, like a chapter that consists almost entirely, or I think maybe entirely, of clippings from newspapers from turn of the 20th century, you know, newspaper columnists who were scandalized by women on bikes. That's one whole chapter. There's another chapter that's almost in sort of dialogue form between this couple that you interview who met on a long distance bike ride. Can you talk a little bit about nonfiction and genre and sort of what genre you intended this book to be?
The main thing I was trying to do when I finally sat down to write this thing after lots of research and reporting was avoid the pitfalls of potted history. Like, I'm kind of a hack historian, but I'm better at journalism or doing reportage. Plus, it was fun. I wanted to go out and get into the bicycle world and tell those stories. So I have a bunch of chapters that are really just grounded in travelogue and reporting. And then I just wanted to, you know, unleash my deep thoughts, man, my musings about the meaning of the bicycle, because that's something that I actually think about a lot when I ride around on bikes, and always have, even before I was ever under contract for a bike book. I was, you know, out on my bike and thinking to myself, you know, why does this feel so good? This is, you know, how weird is it that I'm both the passenger on this bicycle and I'm the engine of the bicycle? So those, as it were, mysteries have kind of obsessed me for years. And so I wanted to, you know, get into that stuff in the book. The one other thing I'll say is that, you know, there's a very sentimental, romantic aspect to writing about the bicycle in general. There's now a kind of revisionist scholarly literature which is taking a more hard-nosed, less hagiographic look at the bike, and I'm down with that revisionist stuff. So I wanted to, for instance, debunk a lot of the sentimental myths that surround bikes, and redress the very American-centric and Eurocentric imbalance in the literature, because the vast, vast majority of the bikes are in the world, and cyclists in the world are in the global South. But if you read most books written about bikes, the only thing you know is that a bunch of white people ride around on them, you know, in nice bike lanes in cities of the West, and you know that. You read a lot about Copenhagen and Amsterdam, but you don't read about, you know, Dhaka and Delhi and Shanghai, which is where there are just so many bicycles and such fascinating cycling cultures.
I wanted to ask you, Jody, a little bit, and maybe that teases an answer to this question, but a little bit about the genesis of this project and what, you know, what strikes me in your description here is that the bike seems both over and under, over familiar and under considered. And what made you feel like there needed to be this consideration, or how are you trying to broaden or expand our understanding with the book?
It was really a personal impulse as opposed to some, like, you know, mission I was on. I really just wanted to reckon with my own questions about bicycles, because, like, I try, as Steve said in his intro, to be, you know, not so sentimental in this book, and try and take a kind of skeptical look at the bicycle, and write, you know, some kind of grown up history of the bike, as opposed to, you know, a lot of the literature, which is like, the bicycle is the redemptive little green machine that's going to save the world, and it's so cute and twee. That's really like a strain in bicycle culture and in bicycle activist culture and in a lot of the literature of the bicycle. But you know, I love bikes, like, out of all proportion. I'm crazy about riding around on my bike, and I love looking at bikes, and I'm, you know, mesmerized. I'm mesmerized by the bikes I see in the street. So it's just something. It's just this topic that has obsessed me for many, many years. And I spent many years just kind of like zoning out, thinking about bikes. And I was like, wait a sec, I write for a living. Why am I spending my time writing about things other than bicycles? And it seemed to me that there was a place, a kind of like hole in the bicycle library, a place for this kind of a book, which is kind of a nonfiction book that crosses genres a little bit, and that is both history and maybe something more like historical essay. So I gave it a shot.
I mean, you did a beautiful job, right? I mean, the essence of criticism is preserving your love in the face of your enlightened skepticism, and bringing your enlightened skepticism to bear on your love, right? And keeping those things in a kind of bicycle-like forward propulsive equilibrium, if you'll allow me to be overstretched and poetic about it. But the book really, I think, inspires that response. It reminded me of so many different kinds of books, but I know you're a fan of this certain kind of history writing, like Carlo Ginzburg, and, like, you know, I would assume City of Courts by Mike Davis, the, in its way, definitive book about LA. It's this amazing thing to come at something kind of, you know, sort of both with enormous synthetic and comprehensive powers and a highly idiosyncratic individual point of view. You get at something so beautiful about the bicycle, right? Which is that it's very much like learning to walk or talk in one sense, but it happens later. So it's elemental, but we remember it. Almost everyone learns how to ride a bike, and almost everyone who's learned how to ride a bike remembers this primal moment of with a parent being unable, presumably with a parent, not always, but most often I would think with a parent being unable to do it, it seeming somewhat mysterious and impossible to master. And then all of a sudden, all of its various elements fuse the physics of the world, the machine, and yourself together, and you're going forward on your own, and you vividly remember it, which you can't for walking, talking, eating, breathing, all these other things. And yet there's also that phrase, it's like riding a bicycle, which you point to, which is, it then becomes as elemental as those. It's like the paradigmatic thing that you just know how to do and never forget. It just felt as though the book was written in the same spirit as riding a bicycle, both this unconscious and conscious thing, both euphoric but also meticulous. And on and on and on. I'll stop.
I mean, you know, what you say about that that kind of primal experience of learning to ride a bike, and that moment, that exhilarating moment of, you know, tasting liberation and autonomy that you experience as a kid, when suddenly you're like whooshing off on two wheels, the adult who's been pushing you along isn't back there anymore, and suddenly you magically, you know how to ride a bike, like the skill is assimilated instantaneously, and nothing's going to shake it loose unless, God forbid, you have some, you know, horrible brain trauma. You know, that's the crazy thing about the way the brain works, and how a skill like bicycle riding, you know, it just kind of gets locked in there. But you know, that feeling of freedom through history has been extended into the political realm, because the bicycle, you know, for all my trying to be a debunker and not be sentimental about the bike and describe, for instance, ways in which the bicycle has been a tool of empire and has extracted an environmental toll in its own right. The bicycle really has been a tool of protest and resistance through the decades, and I think that now we're seeing like the reemergence of the bicycle as a vehicle of protest. We saw it in the Black Lives Matter uprising of 2020. There's a lot of people taking to streets across the world in great numbers on bicycles, and we're experiencing if you look at the stats, this is like the biggest bicycle boom and the most globalized bicycle boom of all, 200 years into the life of this weird, pokey 19th century machine. So that's actually, I think, another, possibly even the biggest reason I wanted to write this thing is because, like, we're in a bike moment. And, what the future of cities arguably depends upon things like bikes are finding more space and for bikes in cities and, getting cars the hell out of cities. And to some extent, although this can be overstated, the future of the planet depends on us finding a more sustainable, saner, healthier, happier way to live. And the bicycle really can be a big part of that. So yeah, that's another reason I wrote the book, because, yeah. Because this is, it 2022 is a real bike moment.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear, and may this book be a big part of that going forward. Jody, I can't quit you. Can you stick around and endorse? We don't do that much anymore, but we'll make time for you. Can you stick around here?
I would love to. Thanks so much.
Okay, well, the book is Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. It's out today from Crown Books. Please pick it up. It is a tremendously worthwhile document. Jody Rosen is going to stick around and endorse. Thanks for sticking around, Jody.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Jody. Thank you for sticking around. What do you got?
Yeah, I kind of strong-armed you, Stephen, to letting me stick around because I feel so evangelical about this endorsement that I had to just like get it out in the world on some platform. So I'm co-opting your platform, and this might feel like a log roll because nominally, in some, I'm a New York Times writer. Like that's I have a regular freelance contract job for the New York Times Magazine. But this is not a log roll because I'm endorsing the work of a writer who's a New York Times critic. I never met this person, never spoken to this person, but I'm so in love with his work that I had to say something about this. Do you guys know who Jason Farrago is, the art critic Jason Farrago?
I was gonna say that's who you were going to say. He is so effing good. I agree. Every single time he steps to the plate, I mean, he is just a tremendously good critic, art critic, art historian, public art historian. He's marvelous.
Right. And in particular, he has kind of pioneered this series in the Times that's called Close Read, which Julia will be interested in this, or maybe she has thoughts about this. This is just one of the
It's so best- good. It's so good. I've been reading them.
Exactly. Most incredible uses of the internet in journalism that I've ever seen to kind of do exegesis, like to explicate and do close reads, as it were, you know, close analysis of works of art. So in the case of Jason Farrago's pieces, he writes very beautifully in these very short little sentences that, and you kind of scroll through and you get a couple sentences per scroll. And what you're doing is looking at a work of art. And the interface works such that you with each scroll, you might like zoom in on a particular detail of the painting as he's talking about that, or zoom out to take in the whole. And these pieces step through art history, the history of ideas, you know, history writ large, and just perform like just the best kind of, yeah, close criticism, you know, like deep criticism. So I want to recommend a couple of pieces in particular to people who just want to get started with Jason Farrago. There's a piece he did about a painting by Berthe Morisot, who's maybe she was American, even though she has a French sounding name. But in any case, she was a lesser known impressionist master. He did a close reading of a Jasper Johns painting, which is just like it's a tearjerker of a piece. He did a close read of a painting called Shah Jahan on a Terrace, which is an in one of those wonderful Indian miniatures. I think it's a 17th century painting. So yeah, just Google around, get to the Times website and check out Jason Farrago's close read pieces. They're all masterful.
Yeah, I endorsed one, the Auden poem, Musée des Beaux-Arts. It's just an amazing, amazing feature. I agree. Dana, what do you have?
Okay, maybe this will be a Jody pleaser of an endorsement, because it has to do with the invention of a technology, as your book on the bike does, and it is also about what I know is one of your favorite substances in the world, coffee. So I'm going to endorse a 10-year-old article from Smithsonian Magazine, but since it's about the old days, I guess it doesn't matter that it's an old article. It's about the invention of espresso, which happened actually right around the same time that I guess the bike was enjoying its boom in sort of the 1890s to the turn of the 20th century. And this article specifically focuses on these two characters, these two Italian inventors, Luigi Bizzera and Desiderio Pavoni, which the article calls the Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs of espresso. So this was sort of like the tech guy and, you know, the guy who knew how to promote the machine. And it just talks about the 1906 World's Fair in Milan when they introduced the fastest coffee making machine that had ever existed. Of course, espresso comes from the Italian word for quickly. And the espresso machine was a wonder at the time because it could very quickly produce this beverage that, you know, Europe had been addicted to at that point for a couple centuries. And it's just a really fun sort of history of technology and snapshot of that moment. There's also some great illustrations of the World's Fair in 1906 in Milan and some patent drawings of the first espresso machine. Anyway, if you're a coffee addict and you're into history, I think you would have fun with this article. We'll put a link on the show page. It's called The Long History of the Espresso Machine.
Oh, man. Keep the assembly line rolling here. We got bikes, coffee, close reading. This is like, I'm like a puppy on its back getting its tummy scratched. Julia, what do you got?
All right. Well, I'm going to bait Jody, even though we've got to close this segment out. But Jody tweeted like 6 weeks ago, I think, that he was obsessed with the Boston restaurant Tate. And I've been wanting to talk to him about it for all the time since, because I, too, am obsessed with the Boston restaurant Tate. This is like an independent kind of Israeli inflected like breakfast, lunch, and pastry place that is delicious in all three of those categories, and then has been kind of massively expanded within Boston. It turns out that some of it was acquired by the CEO or owner of Panera, and then when he sold Panera, he kept Tate. And so Tate is, there's now like 12 or 13 in Boston, and they're expanding to DC, and it's, I ate there nonstop last summer, and I love Boston. I grew up in Boston. I don't think of Boston as like a major hub of food innovation. Come at me, Boston people, whatever, you know, Dunkin' Donuts accepted. But wow, if you're in Boston, you got to go to Tate. And Jody, just have to say, I see you. I see your Tate fandom. Like, what deliciosity.
And if any listener out there knows how you pronounce them, if Tate, is that actually how you pronounce the name of this restaurant? Not sure, but
Unclear. That's one of the things that's so unlikely about it. Wonderful Israeli food chain from Boston. Tat? Can't be called Tat. Doesn't seem like a tat. Anyway, very good though.
All right. So, Jody, you're probably with me on this. There's a very special poignancy to being the second best or maybe even third best songwriter in a band. Of course, the archetypal case is George Harrison, who we all got a refresher on in the Beatles documentary. He can scarcely get the attention of Lennon and McCartney. He's playing songs that go on to become classic songs for them, auditioning them for Lennon and McCartney, the greatest songwriting duo who ever lived. And they're like, yeah, now back to business. And then, I mean, Lennon and McCartney could barely keep their eyes off of one another to see how the other is reacting to the latest thing that they're doing, whether it be Jape or musical scrap or whatever. And Harrison is just invisible. It's just incredibly sad. It happens in band after band after band. There is a star, right? And the star comes in and he's just got the presence, the charisma, the chops, the voice, and the songs, the biggest currency, right? The songs. And there was an example of this that I don't think is especially well known. The bass player for the Replacements was Tommy Stinson. With added poignancy, he became a member of the band when he was in his very early teens and toured a lot of the country, if not parts of the world, when he was like 15 with guys 2, 3, 4 years older than he was. It was because he was the younger brother of the guitarist, who was a major substance abuser, his older brother, Bob. And so he lived formative years on the road playing bass, but I think he's a really underrated front guy and singer and songwriter. He had a band that I adored called Bash and Pop after the Replacements. So what I'm endorsing is this. I found this deep cut YouTube video of while the Replacements were still going, the band, it feels like the band has exited the stage. It does not sound like the regular drummer on the drums, but basically Paul Westerberg just cedes the stage completely, I think indifferently. I don't even think he hands it to Tommy, little Tommy. And Tommy, I guess with a guitar, gets up and plays a song that becomes years later the kind of one of the sort of would-be hits from the Bash and Pop record. It's called Friday Night is Killing Me. It's an early version of the song. It doesn't really sound like the one on the record. And just it's like from 91, we'll post the link to it. The utter poignancy, the heartbreaking, like there was already this deep homesick quality to what the Replacements did, what Westerberg did. And it's just tripled, quadrupled, you know, to have little Tommy Stinson, the perennial younger brother, the second best songwriter in the band. And I think he's just an amazing rock and roller. He's got a great upper register rock and roll voice. His songwriting on that first Bash and Pop record is kind of like the old Faces, classic records. It just has that jump and melody to it. It's just primal stuff. It's really good. Jody, you won't like it at all, but I'll send you the link and you can tell me why I'm wrong.
I will definitely. I'm a huge Replacement fan. What are you talking about, baby?
Oh, wow. Okay. Pleasant surprise. Jody, it was so cool to have you on the show. People must buy your book, Table Pounded. It is so good.
I just have to flag. That's like the most Stephen Jody moment ever. You invite Jody on, you praise his book lavishly, and then at the end, you shade him by being like, you're a music critic who doesn't think the Replacements are good. Come on.
I want to take issue with this, adverb lavishly. I praised it proportional to
judiciously
its excellence.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, actually, I think Steve praised it judiciously too. That was there's nothing lavish about it.
Jody, love you, man. Thanks for coming on the show. It's always really fun.
Thank you so much,
Dana. Julia, really good show. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure.
You will find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the wonderful composer Nick Britell. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistant is Nadira Goff. For Jody, Dana, and Julia, I am Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you soon.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.